morning, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about one of my favorite topics, paid sick leave. I'm scrolling through the list of participants here, and I see a lot of friendly names out there. So hello to all of our clients and friends out there. We're glad you could join us. Today, for your listening pleasure, we have assembled a team, perhaps to confuse you with all the different voices, but hopefully to keep it a little more entertaining. But this group, Angela Vogel, Laura Cherchansky, Paula Simon, and myself, have all been following the development of this law very closely. A lot of us have been attending the various comment sessions that the agency has had, and we have, I think, sorted out most of the questions we've been having among ourselves, and hopefully we can answer your questions along the way. So definitely feel free to post a question, and we will work it in if we can. If it's going to appear later in the presentation, we'll probably skip it for a bit. But we hope to get most of your questions answered as we kind of navigate this new law. So today we're going to cover, you know, the basics, who this applies to, who's eligible, sort of what the law requires you to provide in terms of how many hours, that sort of thing. But we'll talk a little bit about using a PTO policy to comply with your obligation, and also front-loading policies, which have some little unique quirks. You can still do it, but you got to be mindful of a couple of things there. Verifying illnesses. This is definitely a change from those of you who may be more familiar with Seattle's paid sick leave. We'll talk about how you can do that. Increments, just in terms of the minimum increment that you can require folks to take paid sick leave, and whether, when, and why it might be useful to you to try to apply for a variance from that rule. And then interaction with the city ordinances. Spokane's is going to sunset, but we still have Seattle's and Tacoma's to worry about. And then finally, when you need a policy and what it should include. So without further ado, we'll jump right in and we'll turn it over to Laura. Actually, we'll turn it over to Paula.
Thank you. We're going to start with the basics. First, who the law covers. The state law only covers non-exempt employees, specifically employees who are non-exempt under the Washington Minimum Wage Act. So here it's key to know that state law does not cover your exempt employees. Second, the law, which goes into effect January 1, sets minimum standards for sick leave. Employers are free to provide more generous time off than is set out in the state law. But let's take a look at those minimum requirements. First, accrual. The minimum rate for accrual is 1 hour per 40 hours worked.
Paul, and I think we're having a little bit of technical difficulty. We're going to turn up Paula's mic and see if you can hear her. So Paula, continue, and somebody let us know if you can hear her now.
All right. Thank you. So I was just going over the minimum requirements under the law. First, the minimum accrual rate, 1 hour per 40 hours worked. Accrual has to begin on the date of hire for new hires after January 1st or for your current employees effective on January 1st of 2018. For new hires, use of sick leave can be restricted until the 90th day of employment. The law also has a carryover requirement for accrued and unused sick leave. Employers, however, don't have to allow unlimited carryover. Carryover can be capped at 40 hours or any amount above 40. The law does not recognize caps on accrual or use. There may be some nuances to this for employers who offer more generous leave than required under the law, which we can talk about a little bit later. But the key takeaway is that employers cannot have caps on accrual or use that would conflict with an employee's right to accrue and use the minimum amount of 1 hour per 40 hours worked. Accrual and use must be tracked, and on a regular basis, considered at least monthly. Employers must make sure employees have notification of their sick leave use, accrual, and balance. One way would be reporting those amounts on pay stubs. Although the law describes pay stubs as just one way to comply with the requirement, not the exclusive way, it does not offer specific guidance on other acceptable methods. So what about access on the internet? Again, no clear guidance there, but it's probably a reasonable approach that meets the goal of making sure employees can keep tabs on their accruals, use, and balance.
Oh, so Paula, a question came through about, you sort of touched on this, you know, no caps on accrual. So that's a big change, right, or no caps on use, I apologize. That's a big change from Seattle's ordinance. However, if you've got something super generous, like I'm seeing one client here saying they allow 530 hours, I hope I can apply there, of PTO that can accrue. Is there a way you can kind of get around that cap issue if you've got a super generous policy?
That's right. And I think we'll cover this under our PTO section in a little bit more depth. But there are ways to designate amounts that can be used for sick leave. And there are ways that if you offer a much more generous than required, you can craft your policy to try to limit some of the use to just more consistent with what the minimum requirements are under the law. So there's room for flexibility there.
And just to interrupt one more time, there are a few of you are saying you're not able to hear. We are working on that. If there's folks out there who can hear, can you shoot us a comment and make sure this is not a global issue? Anybody hear us out? Anybody out there? Anybody? And if for those of you who cannot hear, we're working on that. All right, great. Okay, so we'll go ahead and continue. We'll get you other folks able to do the audio here just as soon as we can.
Okay. So next we can talk about covered absences. The law sets out a broad array of reasons that employees may use sick leave. Sick leave may be used for the employee's own illness or medical appointment. Employees may also use sick leave to care for family members who are ill or have medical appointments. And family member is defined very broadly to include a child, and there's no restriction as to age, parent-in-law, spouse, registered domestic partner, grandparent, grandchild, or sibling. So Angela now is going to cover some additional details on the paid sick leave law.
Thank you, Paula. I'm going to be talking about some additional details on the law. Can someone advance the slide for me? All right, thank you. So one thing to keep in mind is that you can only request documentation from employees if they've been out for 3 consecutive days, and that can be partial day absences, but you can only request documentation once employees have been out for more than 3 days. Sick leave can also be used in the same increments as you use in your timekeeping system, so whether that be an hour, half an hour, 15 minutes, but sick time should be used in that same incremental way. Another thing to keep in mind is that if an employee leaves your employment and they return within 12 months, you are required to reinstate that sick leave balance and to give the employee notice of what the accrued balance is when they return to work.
Angela, we have a couple questions here that you may know the answer to. Is this hours worked just in Washington if you've got a multi-state employer or maybe an employee who goes back and forth between Idaho and Washington, for example? Are we just looking at hours actually worked in Washington?
I think the answer is yes. It applies to hours worked in Washington because it's a Washington paid sick time policy.
And how about any thoughts on, we've got some part-time non-exempt folks, if I got that right, Darlene, non-exempt person working half-time. Is it still required by prorated? I bet she means exempt, but half-time, because half, like a part-time salaried person, can you still have, you probably can still have it accrue based on their anticipated hours worked?
Right. I think they would still accrue 1 hour for every 40 hours worked.
Okay.
So I'll chime in. This is Laura. I'll chime in and just say, so if you have someone who's working half-time, let's say they work 20 hours per week, it's going to take them 2 weeks to accrue 1 hour of sick leave, whereas your full-time non-exempts, they can accrue 1 hour of sick leave in their typical 40 hours worked. So it is prorated in the sense that it's just going to take them the amount of time it takes, you know, to get up to that full-time time frame. But so if you have a half-time person, it's just going to take them twice as long. Clarify, this is only for your non-exempt, not your exempt, just to make sure that's clear.
Thank you, Laura. So one important aspect of the law is that you can require employees to give notice of their need for leave, and you should have a written policy that lays out these requirements. If there's a need for foreseeable leave, the employee should provide at least 10 days of notice or as soon as it's practicable. If it's unforeseeable leave, then the notice should come in as soon as possible before the start of the shift. But keep in mind that someone else may call in for the employee. The employee themselves don't need to call in if they're unable to. In addition, regarding the rate of pay for sick leave, it's the normal hourly compensation. So that's pretty straightforward for hourly employees. It's going to be a little more complicated for employees who aren't paid on an hourly basis. There is some guidance out there. In the instance, if you have an employee who's paid on commission, you would look at their total hours worked and their total comp and divide that number and come up with the normal hourly compensation, and that's just one method. So just be aware that is an issue you're going to have to face.
And Angela, I've had other clients ask me about this, and I know in the rules, the method you were talking about, it's a 90-day look back, right?
Right.
So you're looking at total hours worked and total compensation for that 90-day period to figure out what's their normal hourly compensation. And I know the rules don't give us much more guidance about other methods, but can you talk a little bit about the fact that this is only one method, and we definitely want to make sure that clients who can't do 90-day look backs, they know they have some other options?
Right. You basically, I mean, it's hard because they didn't use the regular rate of pay in this rule that we look to for overtime calculations. But you need to look to the records that you have and how you would calculate what someone's normally hourly compensation would be. And the rules are just guidelines for that. So use the information you have and really do the best you can to determine what that normal hourly compensation would be. Another important aspect of the law is that it prohibits retaliation from employees using sick time. That could be requesting sick time, using the sick time, you know, complaining about some sort of impediment to using the sick time. And it's really important that you don't take adverse action against the employee for engaging or requesting or using that protected leave. Another important thing to remember is that you can't penalize employees for taking that time off, and you can't count it towards attendance policies. Finally, you need to provide notice to employees. There's a notice requirement in the law of their entitlement to leave by March 1st for current employees and by January 1st for new employees or their hire date. So that's just something to keep in mind going forward, and we'll address that a little bit more in this presentation. And now Laura's going to talk about PTO.
Well, I know we had some questions that came in on this slide. So before I advance it, I'm going to go ahead and answer some of those. So we'll just stay here for a moment. So Jillian, we had a question about rehire. Is that right?
Yeah. So we've got, first of all, if someone's been rehired, can you start over that 90-day waiting period before they're able to use any accrued sick leave?
So if an employee is rehired within that 12-month period, then the answer is no, they don't have another 90-day waiting period. Basically, their past service counts towards that waiting period. So if someone worked for you for less than 90 days, let's say someone worked for you for 60 days, you might have a temporary or a seasonal employee, they've worked 60 days, you rehire them within 12 months, they get credit for that past 60 days. They have to work another 30 days before they can begin using their accrued sick leave. So keep in mind that if you're within that one-year period of rehiring someone, they do get credit for past service towards the waiting period. If it's outside of the 1 year, then you're back to they get a full 90-day waiting period.
So for your person who was here 60 days and then is gone for a period of time and comes back within that 12-month period, not only do they get credit for 60 days, they actually will eventually get to use whatever they accrued during that 60-day period.
That's exactly right. So if you have temporary employees who are only with you for, you know, 2 months out of the year because it's seasonal, you might think, well, I never have to worry about them because they're never going to hit 90 days. And that's not the case. You don't have to worry about them using sick leave in year one, but by year two or year three, if they keep coming back, they would definitely at some point be able to use their accrued sick leave.
We also have a question about whether you have to pay out any remaining sick leave upon separation. You do not, although you could if you'd like to. Another question about what is the rate that you're paying folks if they are taking a day off. This involves a restaurant that pays their servers a service charge. So the restaurant, you know, charges customers a service charge. They pass that part of that charge to their servers via a commission plan. Do we have to incorporate that when figuring out the average rate of pay?
No. So the good news for restaurants is that service charges are not included in what is considered. So tips and service charges, gratuities, are not included in what is considered the normal. Commissions are different. So if you have someone, for instance, if you have a beverage director who gets a portion of, you know, a sales on commissions, that would have to be included in the normal rate of pay. But if your servers, for instance, are just getting a portion of the service charge, the law says that that's not included in – and we'll go ahead and check up on that, and we will circle back later in the presentation.
Yeah, in this particular restaurant, you know, it's a commission plan. So it's a commission, but they're funding that commission pool through service charges. So we'll have to get back to you on that particular conundrum, but we'll follow up with that within the hour if we can.
And then going back to the idea of reinstatement and paying out sick leave on termination, as Jillian said, you do not have to pay out any accrued but unused sick time at termination. If you choose to do so, the rules say that you should have a written agreement with the employee talking about the terms and conditions. We think that something as simple as having in your handbook the policy about how you're going to pay out at termination, and then having a signed form from the employee acknowledging the policy is likely sufficient to meet that written agreement. If you do pay out your accrued but unused sick time at termination, you do not need to reinstate that sick leave balance if rehired within 12 months. So it's an either or. You either reinstate, or if you have paid it out, you don't have to reinstate.
Just one more question, then I think we'll move on. Once an employee has exhausted accrued sick time under this statute, can subsequent absences be counted towards an attendance policy without violating the prohibition against retaliation? So yes, I mean, if you've been accruing one for 40 and you've used all that, if you're absent again and you don't have enough to cover that absence, then that absence can be counted against you. Now remember, though, accrual continues. So to the extent this employee continues to work, you know, eventually they're going to be accruing some every pay period. So, but if they are out or don't have enough to cover the whole absence, you can count that against them.
Okay, so we will move on now to PTO policies, paid time off policies. If you are not familiar with this term, a paid time off policy is one where an employer combines vacation time, sick time, any other sort of personal paid time off into one bucket, and employees can use that time for whatever they want. So if they're sick, fine. If they want to just go take a wonderful vacation, that's great too. So I know a lot of you who have PTO policies are asking, okay, if I have a PTO policy, am I good? Am I done? You know, can I just check the box and say we're good with Washington sick leave? And the answer is maybe. A PTO policy is going to comply with the law as long as it meets or exceeds every requirement of the law. And so I've listed out the kind of the five key ones here, which is the accrual rate. And you can do a PTO policy as an accrual or as a front load, and I'll talk about front loading next. But as long as your employees are being given at least the 1 for 40 in terms of PTO time, that's going to be compliant with the accrual rate. You have to allow carryover, up to 40 hours carryover from 1 year to the next. There's no exception for a PTO policy, so you have to make sure that you have some sort of carryover language or allowance in your policy. You have to comply with the increments of use. We learned about that you know, what increment can they use their PTO time in. You can't necessarily restrict it to full day use, half day use, 1 hour of use. It's a little bit more detailed than that, and you'll hear more about that later in the presentation. No retaliation. I know that's not one that's going to be causing anyone heartburn, but no retaliation for taking PTO, and also only requesting documentation after 3 consecutive days absence. So those are sort of the key requirements in the law that your PTO policy would have to comply with in order to meet this legal obligation. Now, here's where it gets a little bit more interesting and where there might be more discussions that need to happen internally to figure out if your policy is going to going to meet the requirements of the law. An employer can choose to designate a portion of their PTO balance as being specifically for sick leave, tracked separately, as covered under the law. If you don't designate some portion, then your entire PTO balance is considered good for employees to use for covered sick leave. And here's why that matters. Let's say that you have a very generous PTO policy and you offer employees 100 hours per year. If you don't have any sort of a designation, that means that full 100 hours is protected under the law. They can use it in small increments. You can only request documentation after 3 days, et cetera, everything I just talked about. If instead you designate a portion as being for covered sick leave and you have some sort of way of tracking that separately, then you can only say for those specific absences used for a sick leave purpose, those are the covered absences under the law. Now, this is obviously very complicated, and I'm sure that people have lots of questions about how to make it work. It's hard to answer it in the sort of abbreviated time that we have, but something that we definitely wanted to flag for you.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions on this too. I think the way I've been describing it is if you've got that 100 hours of PTO, anytime, and you haven't designated a portion of it for sick leave, anytime someone wants to use any of those hours for a sick leave purpose, all the bells and whistles apply. Now, if somebody wants to go to Hawaii, those bells and whistles don't apply. So if you can require more notice if somebody's going to go to Hawaii. You can deny that leave if it doesn't work for your business needs. That's still okay, even with one full bucket of PTO. But you just have to know that if you don't designate that portion for sick leave, all those 100 hours may be required to have all those bells and whistles. So it's important to designate that portion if you want to make sure that you're going to have a little more flexibility for those other hours.
That's exactly right. And then the last point with PTO is that you don't have to give more sick leave if an employee goes out and uses up their PTO balance and then all of a sudden they get sick. And now they're saying, oh, well, you have to give me sick leave under the law. That's not the way it works. If the employee goes to Hawaii for 3 weeks and they have a wonderful trip and then they use up all of the PTO that they've accrued, they are not entitled to anything more. So PTO works really well for some employers that want to meet all the obligations under the law, give employees a little bit more for vacation as well, and put it all in one bucket. Other employers prefer to keep sick and vacation separately, completely up to you. But if you do want to have a PTO policy, this is what you'd have to do. So the other sort of big topic that I get to talk to you about is front loading. So some employers like to give employees at the beginning of the year just a big bucket of time that they can use for sick leave. And under the law, that is allowed. Employers can front load sick leave at the beginning of the year, but again, as long as it complies with all the requirements of the law. And one of the tricky things to think about is how many hours do you front load? So if you think about the average worker working 40 hours per week, and accruing 1 hour for every 40 hours worked. Most employees under that sort of a framework are going to accrue 52 sick leave hours because they're accruing one sick leave hour per week. There's 52 weeks in the year. So you might think, great, if I just front load 52 hours, I'm good. But there's the carryover requirement. So at the end of year one, you've front loaded your 52 hours. That's the perfect amount. The employee has worked exactly 40 hours every week. But at the end of the year, if they have any time left over that they haven't used, that has to carry over into year two. So at year two, if they've carried over 20 hours, you can't just say to them, okay, you get a maximum of 52 hours this year, because that's not taking into account the 20 hours of carryover. So if you want to do a front-loading policy, think carefully about how many hours that you're going to give at the beginning of the year and how you're going to deal with this carryover requirement. Throughout the year, if employees work extra, they may be entitled to additional sick leave. So if someone is working overtime, you know, you're really busy in the summer, and for, you know, a month and a half, that employee is working not 40 hours, they're working 45 hours a week. You have to make sure there's some way for you to check in and ensure that you're giving those employees extra sick leave to account for the fact that they are working extra hours. So if you're front loading a more generous policy, you're not just front loading the 52 bare minimum, you're front loading more, you know, as long as you're coming up with a reasonable estimate of what you think those employees are going to work, you're likely going to be fine, but make sure you have a way to check. And then, as I mentioned, there's no exception for carryover under a front-loading policy. So the law does not say, for instance, if you front-load X hours, you don't have to worry about tracking accrual and you don't have to worry about carryover. That's not the way this works. You have to make sure you're still tracking accrual, you're still giving employees notice of their balances, and that you have some way in your policy to account for carryover. One of the things that we've sort of been talking about here is using language like, you know, up to 40 hours are deemed carried over from 1 year to the next, and then in January we're front-loading an additional amount up to X hours. That may work as long as you're making sure that you're choosing those amounts carefully. So again, this is something that's complicated. It's hard to give you all the details in a short webinar, but something for you to be thinking about internally.
And we have a lot of questions coming in about really specific policies. You know, one organization has a 960-hour PTO cap, wondering if they need to increase it to 1,000 beginning in January to comply with that 40-hour carryover. No, I mean you have to allow 40 to carry over, but then whatever you want to put on top of that is fine. There's a lot of other questions about various balances. One question is about this woman is wondering whether there's correct in her assumption that use is different than accrual. Yes, meaning that they can accrue more than they are allowed to use, must provide 40 hours per year, but could carry over more. No, that is not correct. That was the issue in Seattle. You may be familiar with that. The accrual kind of would go on forever, but there was a cap on use. So if you hit your use cap, you would continue to accrue, and then you'd have some to carry over. That is very different than the Washington law. In Washington, there's no cap on either accrual or use. So as much as they are able to accrue in a year, and if you've got someone who's working a ton of overtime, that could be far more than 40 hours per year. They are allowed to use it as soon as they accrue it. And this feeds into another question that asked, when can you retaliate, essentially? At what point can you discipline? Do you have to wait till the end of the year? But no, it's you have to have PTO or sick leave available to use at that moment that you want to use it. And if you haven't accrued enough, you can discipline someone for being absent in June, let's say, and then they'll continue to accrue, and then maybe they will have some that they can use. But it's sort of an ongoing process.
And there's a question about when does the carryover start? Like, are we talking about carrying over right now? You have to carry over into January 1? No. So this law takes effect January 1. So starting January 1 is when they start accruing. And then December 31, 2018, they get to carry over into 2019 up to 40 hours of accrued but unused sick leave. So if you have a current policy that has a more generous cap or anything like that, that's fine for 2017. But when you start January 1, 2018, that's when these new requirements go into effect. And so if you have a very generous policy, it's not okay under the law to cap accrual at any point. Even if your cap is 1,000 hours, if you have someone who comes in January 1, 2018, has 1,000 hours, they still start accruing January 1, 2018. So you can't just say, we give people so much sick leave. It really is under this law, there are no caps on accrual. So there's lots of different strategies for how to do this. You could have, you could put a chunk into a different bank, for instance, and just have a bare bones minimum sick leave balance that is revolving under this law. So if you have one of these really generous policies and you're looking for strategies, any one of us can help you tweak language, get some things in there to make it compliant, but just something to be aware of. Even if you're being extra generous, that doesn't mean that you're going to be in compliance with the law. And do we have any more questions, Jillian, or are we good to move on?
We do have a question about if someone works 400 hours of overtime in a year, they would earn 62 hours of sick leave. I'm not sure I think that math works out, but yeah, it's 1 hour for every 40 hours worked. No matter how many hours you work in a week, it's just going to keep, that clock's going to keep ticking, and you can accrue as much as you can possibly accrue, you can use in that year.
Okay, well, keep those questions coming in. We'll go ahead and move on to our next slide, but don't hesitate to throw those questions out there.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about verification of illness. And when can you ask for verification? You can only require documentation after there's been 3 consecutive absences. And as I mentioned before, it doesn't have to be full day absences. It could be partial day. But until that point, the law prohibits you from requesting verification. Also, if you are going to request verification, you need to have a written policy that puts the employees on notice that you will be asking for verification. So that's another reason why it's a good idea to have a written policy. It gives you a tool to ask for a documentation about the absence. And then how do you verify? You should not be asking for specific medical information, but you can be asking for certifications from doctors about, you know, the time period that the employee was out. If you do receive confidential health care information, you need to keep it confidential. And one thing that the law does is provides that employees need to provide that information to you within a reasonable time period. And that time period is something you can define in your policy. It shouldn't be less than 10 days under the law. However, the employee under this new law has the right to assert that getting the documentation, the verification that you're requesting, would cause them an unreasonable burden, which is something that's new. And so the employee, if that's the case, the employee needs to let you know, either orally or in writing, why it creates this burden. And then you as the employer have 10 days to kind of figure out if there's some alternatives that will work for you. That could include, you know, accepting the employee's verification or mitigating their out-of-pocket expenses to get that information. If there is a dispute as to whether or not you're going to accept the verification or it would create an undue burden on the employee, then the employee may make a complaint, and that may be something that you have to deal with. But just be aware that this is something that should be in your policy, and that the employee may claim that there is an unreasonable burden on them. One thing that the policy doesn't do is create an exception for suspected abuse or misuse. But this is why it's a good reason to have a policy that creates a notice provision for the employee to let you know when they have a need for leave and to provide you with verification when you've requested it. One thing to keep in mind is that the law itself allows you to discipline employees for violations of the policy, so for not following the notice requirements or not providing the verification information. But you should be very clear if you are disciplining the employees that it relates to their failure to follow the policy, and you shouldn't discourage them from taking the leave. It's also important to keep in mind that discipline should be really proportional to what the issue is, and you need to be consistent across the board. One other thing to keep in mind is that there may be additional laws that provide for other verification requirements. That includes the FMLA or the ADA. So, and if employees out frequently or they're asking for an extended time period of leave, this may be time to get your HR people involved and get that FMLA or ADA paperwork to the employee so that you can get additional information to assess whether or not they may be eligible for other types of leave.
I'm going to talk a little bit about increments of use under the sick leave law. So how do they actually go about using it? As the default under the law, increments are tied to the employer's payroll system, not to exceed 1 hour. So what this means is that the appropriate increment of use will vary employer to employer, and it's tied to how employees are paid. So, for example, if your employees are paid in 15-minute increments, then they may use their sick leave in 15-minute increments. So there's also going to be a variance program because these tiny increments just really won't work for everybody. So how this works is that it's going to be an application-based system where an employer will fill out an application for a variance to allow employers to require their employees to use sick leave in larger increments than these 15 minutes, anything up to an hour, however employees are paid. So how this is going to work is that they're going to be setting up this application system. It doesn't appear to be launched quite yet, but what employers are going to have to prove, they're going to have to establish good cause to get this variance, and it has a couple of different parts. First, you have to be able to show that compliance with the requirements for increments of use under the law are infeasible. And in addition to that, you have to also prove that or show that granting the variance will not have a significant harmful effect on the health, safety, and welfare of the involved employees. So on your application, you'd have to identify the group of employees that you think should be covered by the variance and also identify what the preferred increment of use will be. One thing that the rules suggest could be relevant in their decision as to whether to grant the variance is the existence of a collective bargaining agreement that already talks about what increments of use employees should be relying on for use of sick leave. So that's one thing that they'll be taking into account. During the variance application review process, the employees who are going to be covered and unions, if applicable, will have the right to voice their opinion. The employer will have to let the employees know that they're applying for this variance. The application process is expected to take about 60 days, but it does look like it might be possible to obtain a temporary variance while your review is being, while your application is being reviewed. On LNI's website, as I said, the formal application process is still listed as coming soon, but what we're hearing is that they're encouraging people who do want a variance to find another way to apply.
Quick question.
Sure.
So if I have morning sickness, let's say I'm pregnant, I'm sick in the morning, and I'm late to work 12 minutes, can I get 12 minutes of, can I use 12 minutes of my paid sick leave to cover that late arrival?
So the answer is yes. So, well, it depends. The exact increment of use, again, is tied to your timekeeping system. So if you are 12 minutes late and the increment is 15 minutes, then you would be allowed to use your sick leave in 15-minute increments. For some employers, it might be 6 minutes or 10 minutes, but you would be allowed to use your sick leave for that reason in the increment that is tied to your payroll system. Okay. Oh, that's right. So the last thing I wanted to cover has to do with CBA waivers or lack thereof. Unlike the city ordinances that recognized waivers for collective bargaining agreements, the state law does not recognize those types of waivers. So employers with collective bargaining agreements, you are not excluded from coverage under this law.
Okay, great. Thanks, Paula. So let's talk about those city ordinances. We have several cities here in Washington that have had sick leave laws. As Jillian mentioned at the top of our presentation, Spokane's law is sunsetting. So that actually was drafted with the knowledge that this new state law was coming into effect. So Spokane said, okay, our law is going away at the end of 2017. Starting in 2018, you just comply with the state law. But what about Seattle and Tacoma? And for if you have any hospitality and transportation employers out there, SeaTac is another one that is around. And we'll spend most of our time talking about Seattle and Tacoma. Those are, I know, apply to all employers who work in those cities. So unfortunately, the answer is you still have to comply with those laws where they are more generous than the state leave law. And there are several key areas that are different and that you will have to figure out a way to make your policy work for both statewide and Seattle and Tacoma. So both Seattle and Tacoma have announced that they're going to vote on amendments to the ordinances that would bring them in line with the state law. And that is where there was a conflict or where the city law was less protective. So for example, Seattle had a waiting period of 180 days
the state law has a waiting period of 90 days. So Seattle Office of Labor Standards has proposed an amendment going to the City Council this month to change the waiting period to 90 days, so it's going to be the same as the state law. That all sounds good. That, you know, sounds like, okay, at least we're not complying with a bunch of different things. But I think the key difference to keep in mind is Seattle and Tacoma, those ordinances cover exempt employees. So if you are a statewide employer, your non-exempt employees are entitled to sick leave outside of Seattle and Tacoma, and all employees inside of Seattle and Tacoma are entitled to paid sick leave. Another difference is that in Seattle, for the domestic violence leave, it's domestic violence, assault, stalking, things like that. In addition to family member, it also includes a household member. So that could be someone in a dating relationship, someone who shares a child with someone else, any blood relative. It's pretty broad. So that would be a covered use in Seattle. For Seattle, the large Tier 3 employers, that you have a higher accrual rate. So instead of one for 40 hours, you accrue at one for every 30 hours worked. Both Tier 2 and Tier 3 employers in Seattle also have higher carryover rates. So a Tier 2 has a 56-hour carryover requirement. Tier 3 has a 72-hour carryover requirement. And if you have a PTO plan in Seattle, the carryover is 108 hours. None of these are new, so if you're a Tier 2 or Tier 3 employer in Seattle, you already know all that. The bad news I am sharing is just that doesn't go away. You still have to comply with those more generous policies. Tacoma includes bereavement leave as a covered use of sick leave, so if you have operations in Tacoma, that still applies. And as far as how do you deal with this, you can have one policy statewide that is the most generous aspects and covers everyone. You can have a policy that applies to everyone who's not in Seattle and Tacoma, and then a specific Seattle or Tacoma policy, or some hybrid of those things where you have one policy with specific carve-out language. So just think carefully about how you want to handle your policies, but there are definitely ways around it.
Laura, what about our friends out there who were able to get a CBA waiver under the Seattle ordinance? Any ideas on how that might be viewed by the state agency?
Right. So as Paula mentioned, the state law does not have a waiver provision. And so in response to the state law, OLS has recently proposed amending the ordinance to sunset the waiver at the end of 2018. So if you have a CBA waiver right now in Seattle, you're okay as far as the more generous provisions of the Seattle law until the end of 2018, but then that goes away. So starting January 1, 2019, you must comply with these sort of more generous provisions of the Seattle law.
And sorry, just to clarify, the Washington sick leave law, the new one, only applies to non-exempt employees, so only your hourly employees. Seattle's and Tacoma's and I believe SeaTac's all apply to all employees. But just we've been going back and forth a little bit, so just to be clear, we're just talking about non-exempt employees. So you can do whatever you want for your exempt employees so long as you're not in Seattle, Tacoma, or SeaTac.
That's right. And there's also some other, you know, unusual categories of employees. So if you have employees that are exempt under the Minimum Wage Act, then they are not covered by the sick leave law. So, for instance, independent contractors are not covered by the sick leave law. We're not going to tell you whether or not you're properly classifying them, but just in general, that's something to think about. And just be very clear who you are covering in your policy. And at the top of the slide, when we're talking about the basics of the law, we actually cited the provision of the law that talks about who is and who is not a quote-unquote employee covered by these laws. So definitely take a look at that. For most employers, the ones who are exempt are your management, your, you know, outside salespeople, your you know, things like that, administrative exempt employees. So those are the ones who are not covered by the state law.
And then just a couple more questions, or a couple folks asking the same question actually about that carryover and how carryover works if you have a front-loaded plan. And as you may recall, friends in Seattle, there is a specific rule that says, hey, if you front-load, you don't have to worry about carryover. That is not the case under the Washington law. Even if you front-load 100 hours a year, you still have to allow them to carry over up to 40 of unused sick leave to the next year. So what that means is if you're in the habit of front-loading 100 hours, what you'll probably want to do is adjust your language that says, at the beginning of the calendar year, you may carry over up to 40 hours of unused PTO from the year before, and then we'll front load an additional amount that brings you up to 100 hours. So you're still effectively front loading 100 hours, but you're just taking into account that a portion of that is going to be carried over from the year prior. And if somebody doesn't have any to carry over, you're just going to be front loading the full 100 hours.
So the other kind of point on the Seattle and Tacoma laws is that both Seattle and Tacoma ordinances require really specific information to be in a written sick leave policy. Jillian's going to talk in just a moment about the state law and what's required under state law. So I'm not going to take the time to talk about all of these bullet points. They are here. They're in your materials. If you are in Seattle or Tacoma, double check and make sure that your policy has these important things. You know, for example, front-loading policy is one of the bullets here under the Seattle in the Seattle box. If you don't have a front-loading policy, this does not have to be in your policy, clearly. But if you do have a front-loading policy, you have to talk about it. For Seattle, you have to put your tier size. Are you a tier 1, 2, or 3? That must be in a written policy. Seattle requires that you have a written policy. And those first few bullet points, the first five, tier size, benefit year, rate of accrual, use and carryover, method of notifying employees, and notice requirements, those are all requirements that were in the law before. They've also added the right to PSST and the no retaliation as required elements of your policy. The rest of them you include if you apply. Same thing with Tacoma. There's some requirements there about what has to be in a policy and other things that you would include if they apply to your specific policy. So I'm not going to go through all of those, but they are there and something good to check your policy against. And I'll turn it over to Jillian.
Great. Okay, so do you need a written sick leave policy? Well, as Laura just mentioned, in Seattle, if you're a Seattle employer, you do. If you're a non-Seattle employer, you don't actually need one unless your policy has or your practice has a couple different functions. So you're only required to have a written sick leave policy under the state law if you require employees to give notice of the need for leave. If you're one of those employers that just allows folks to be absent and they can just sort of take that, you know, request that time maybe through some sort of computer function, then you don't require notice. If you are going to take advantage of your ability to require documentation of the need to be absent after those three consecutive absences, then you're going to need to have a policy describing what that looks like. You're also going to need to have a written policy if you choose to front load, since front load has some quirky features to it. The law requires you to have that in writing. And then also if you allow employees to participate in a shared leave, donating leave to one another, then that needs to be in writing. So, I mean, really, do you need a written sick leave policy? If you ask me, yes, you do, because I can't think of any of my clients that have a sick leave policy that doesn't have at least some requirements to provide some notice, those sorts of things. And I think it's just also probably important for employees to understand what they're provided, sort of how that's going to work. It's probably the only part of the handbook they really ever read. So in terms of, let me take advance this here, of what should be in a policy, there's actually a model policy that the agency has put out. It's fine. I think it'll get you started, but we've been working on sort of what we think should be in a model policy. It needs to talk about who is eligible, sort of when they become eligible, how much they get, sort of all the basics, how much that can be carried over. And then in terms of just a sick leave policy, you're going to want to explain the purposes for which they may use that paid time off. A PTO policy, it may not be necessary to identify the purposes for, you know, usually you can use PTO for any reason, though it may still be advantageous to put in those purposes, as an employer is going to want to potentially preserve the right to say, hey, if you're using this to go to Hawaii, we're going to require more notice. So you may still need to articulate those purposes for when it's a sick leave covered absence. How employees give notice, when employers are going to require documentation, and then a big one is what happens to unused sick leave at termination. We really recommend putting in one way or the other, either you pay it out or you don't. And if you choose to pay it out, remember, if you're putting that in a policy and you're promising employees that when they separate, you will be paying them for their unused paid time off, that becomes a promise that you need to keep. Because if for some reason you don't end up paying that out, let's say this person left under bad circumstances and you don't think they deserve their week of unused PTO, if you've promised to pay that out, that's akin to failing to pay them wages, and we all know that's not a good thing. So definitely spell that out one way or the other. And then any other, you know, if you're in Seattle, you've got some other bells and whistles like you will not be retaliated against and those sorts of things.
And Jillian, we had a couple questions that came in. So before you move on, I think now would be a good time to pause. So can the policy be in the employee handbook?
Absolutely. That's a great place for it. I don't know how many people out there have an actual bound paper copy of the employee handbook anymore, but certainly it's a good place to have it in there or to live on your intranet. Anywhere you keep your other policies is a good place for it to be.
Okay, our current handbook states that employees must contact their supervisor at least 2 hours before their scheduled shift if they're not going to be able to come to work. Is that going to be okay?
So this is an issue under all the paid sick leave laws, including Seattle's. You can have call-in procedures where you ask employees to call in and give a certain amount of notice, 2 hours, 6 hours, those sorts of things. However, you need to have language in there that says if they are unable to do so, you will not enforce that call-in policy. So if someone's calling in for a sick leave purpose and they're not able to call in 2 hours in advance because they just got sick suddenly or they were, you know, in a car accident or something, you cannot enforce that call-in procedure for that absence. So what that means is not only should you make that clear in any written sick leave policy that you have, but if you have a separate call-in procedures policy living somewhere elsewhere in the handbook, be sure to carve that out in that policy too. And really in any policy where you talk about attendance expectations, you should always carve out something that says, by the way, protected leaves of absence will not be held against you. And there's all sorts of protected leaves of absence. So make sure you look at all your policies that talk about your attendance expectations to make sure they are compliant. So, and by the way, we've been talking about verification, right? We've got this verification that's due to employees on March 1st. Now, notification. Notification must go to employees on March 1st. Even if you're not making any changes to your policy is perfectly compliant, you still need to notify employees of this new law and their new rights under this new law. So you can do that by providing the information that we talked about earlier. But you could also, especially if you're going to be making changes to your policy, providing the new policy could be that verification as well. And I think in most cases it is. However, you just need to make sure then, if you're relying on your new policy to be the verification, that it includes things like, by the way, you won't be retaliated against. So make sure that if you're going to do a notification and a policy or just use your policy as a notification, make sure you've got the right information in those documents. So most of you, I think, have, and from the questions coming in, most of you have some sort of paid time off policy. So what you're going to need to do is look at what you've got and see what you need to change. And so this is a checklist of the things that we're seeing that most employers need to just make sure comply. Even folks with super generous policies need to kind of check these things to make sure they comply with the new law. So it's, again, at least 1 hour for every 40 hours worked. If you've got sort of a flat 8 hours every pay period, that's not going to work for folks who are working overtime. So you need to make sure the time accrues as fast as the law says it should accrue. Carryover, obviously a big one. They have to be allowed to carry over 40 hours each year. If you're front loading, you're going to need to adjust your language to sort of reflect that you're counting carryover. No cap on use, no cap on accrual. That's a big one that has to change in most folks' policies. Explain how employees request leaves pretty much as soon as possible is going to be language that you're going to need to insert. If you've got some sort of 30 days in advance or 10 days in advance, you're going to need to adjust that language to say, or as soon as practical. Explain when employer will require documentation of leave. You can't do it if it's for a sick leave purpose until after that third absence. So it's really on that fourth time they call in is when you can ask for verification. But remember, your policy also has to let employees know that they have the right to say, hey, going to get this doctor's note is too unreasonable, it's a burden on me, and then you can interact with them to figure out if there's a way you can get the kind of verification that you want and need without causing them that burden. We think it's a good idea to define who a family member is. If left undefined, folks might get a little bit creative about who they include in their family. And remember, that's going to have to be more broad than what you might have, including siblings and grandchildren and such. You want to make sure that your policy includes the purposes for which the leave can be taken, that accrual begins on the date of hire, and that waiting period to use is going to be, in some cases, shrunk down to 90 days. So in Seattle, your policy probably says 180 days, and now it has to say 90 days. On that 90th day, they can use it. And then reinstatement, if rehired within 12 months, the Seattle's version is, I think, 7 months. And so you need to broaden that up to 12 months. And then make sure it's clear that covered absences won't count towards attendance policies. And then any other bells and whistles that you may have, like PTO and front loading.
All right, so now we're going to go into your to-do list. You've seen the checklist, so here's what we recommend that you do going forward to get ready for January 1st. Number one is obviously review and revise your sick leave policies to bring them into compliance with state law and any city ordinances that might apply to you. And if you don't have a written sick leave policy already, you'll want to decide if you want or need to create one. Equally as important is to make sure that the people who will be enforcing, interpreting your policy really understand what's required, your managers and HR, because you want to make sure that they're not disciplining anybody or requiring verification, things like that, in situations where they're not entitled to do so under the law. So training, very important. Next, Jillian talked about the notification that needs to go out. It needs to go to your current employees by March 1st. New hires starting on January 1st going forward, it needs to be provided on hire. Those four things that need to be in your notice are bullet-pointed in your materials, the entitlement to sick leave, the accrual rate that they will be receiving their sick leave in, the covered uses, and the fact that retaliation is prohibited. And as Jillian mentioned, you might be able to send your policy as the notification itself, as long as those four points are included. And then finally, you'll want to check and make sure you have the updated workplace poster ready to go. The state has theirs available now online, and Seattle has also just updated its policy. So those are out there and ready to go. So there's your to-do list, and now we can turn back and take a few additional questions.
Sure. So we've got some good questions coming in. Let's see how many of them we can answer. So what happens if you start accrual on the day of hire, just like you're supposed to, but an employee is sick before they've accrued enough hours to cover the absence? So 1 hour for every 40 hours work. Let's say they work 40 hours a week. You know, it's going to take 8 weeks to accrue 8 hours. So if they need to be absent on week two and you allow them to be absent, sort of what happens to that time? Can you allow them to sort of borrow from a future accrual?
So you don't necessarily have to allow them to borrow. I mean, basically what it means is that they have however many hours they've accrued, that is their protected sick leave time they can take. So if they have worked 2 weeks and they have 2 accrued sick leave hours, they are protected to take 2 hours of leave. If they need to be absent for the whole day, the 2 hours is protected. The rest of the day is not necessarily protected leave. Could you discipline? Theoretically, yes. Would you want to? That is maybe more of a strategy decision. And could it be considered risky? Yes, in the sense that you really don't, under this law, you don't want to discourage your employees from taking leave. If you have a problem employee that is really abusing this, so for instance, as soon as they accrue 2 hours of leave, they go take a full day off, and they do this regularly, well, that might be a time when you're saying, like, okay, this is not acceptable. You get two hours off. You have 2 protected hours. So yeah. Theoretically, yes, you could only allow them to take the 2 hours. You could allow them to take the whole day and count the other 6 hours as an attendance violation, or you could just allow them to take 2 hours paid, 6 hours unpaid. Lots of options there, but the thing to keep in mind is that the whatever they've accrued is their protected time.
What about that employee who just happens to be sick nearly every other day for the first 15 minutes of the day? What can an employer do when they may feel like this employee is taking advantage of that?
Well, I think one of the things that we talked about before is there may be other laws that apply. So if an employee is, using intermittent leave on a regular basis, perhaps they have an ongoing condition that may be covered by the FMLA, or perhaps they have a disability that you may need to engage in the interactive process with them to see if there's a reasonable accommodation that you can provide for them. So I think if you have these reoccurring either small absences or, lengthy time periods for absences, I think that's when you start your discussion with your HR people and your employee and figure out, is there another law that applies, and can we request additional information to verify what's going on?
So under Seattle, there's that provision that says if there's a clear pattern of abuse or you've got some sort of concern that someone's abusing the rules, you can ask for verification earlier than the 3 days. Do we have something similar under this law? We do not. So the jury's a little still out on sort of how to deal with folks who you think may be lying about the reasons they're absent. So hopefully, if that occurs, reach out to your friendly neighborhood employment lawyer and we'll figure out sort of a way to deal with that. But ultimately, people have to be using this for the purposes it is intended to be used. And actually, that leads into another question in terms of when you can routinely ask for verification. It's after the third absence, consecutive absence. Now, that doesn't – if people work full-time, that's a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. If somebody only works Monday, Wednesday, Friday, then they need to have called in Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then on the following Monday, you can ask for verification.
One other piece of that that's important to note is that it doesn't have to be consecutive full day absences. It's use of any amount of sick leave on the 3 consecutive days that would get you to that threshold.
So there's your 15-minute late person, 3 days in a row or 3 shifts in a row, no matter when they're scheduled. You can ask for verification at that point. Let's see. There's a question about sharing the link to a model policy. We'll absolutely circulate that around. Let's see. What else do we have?
There's a question about the 90-day waiting period. Do long-term employees have a 90-day waiting period starting January 1? No. If they have already worked 90 days as of January 1, they're entitled to use leave, but they don't necessarily have any accrued leave as of January 1 under this law. So if January 1 you start accruing leave, your long-term employees don't have to fulfill any sort of a waiting period, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have leave available on January 1. That would depend more on what you currently have offered and how your policy works.
So a couple questions that are similar that just to clarify, if an employee is still within their 90-day waiting period, so they were hired fewer than 90 days ago, but has accrued as they should have, they should start accruing on that very first day. So they've accrued 2 hours of sick time and they are absent before they are allowed to use the sick time under the law. Is that time protected? No, you don't have to allow them to use it. So if an employee is within their 90-day period and they are absent, it doesn't matter how much they've accrued. They can't use it. Now, you can let them be absent and perhaps you might allow them to do an unpaid leave, or perhaps that might be an attendance violation. But during that first 90 days, you can deal with them in whatever manner you see fit.
And you'd want to make sure that your policy is really clear that you have that 90-day wait period.
There's a question about this organization has an extended illness bank, and so it looks like they require the use of 24 PTO hours before accessing the extended illness bank. Can we continue to use this policy under the new law? So you can continue to have that structure, but just know that if someone is absent for a sick leave purpose and within those first 24 hours of PTO, you have to allow them to use some amount of some PTO from some bank. They have to be allowed to use it. And you can't hold that against them. So I think the rules are actually silent on extended illness banks, but you can certainly have different buckets of leave to sort of satisfy these obligations, but you just need to make sure that the employee is still getting everything they should. 1 hour for 40 hours worked, the ability to use it for those purposes with very little or no notice. So long as you can kind of keep those key provisions in mind, then sure, you can make them draw from different banks in different orders to make it work. So let's see. Someone wants the list of family members that are acceptable. Those are back there on the checklist. It's child, parent, parent-in-law, spouse, domestic partner, grandchild, grandparent, or sibling. Let's see. What else do we have? At what point are you able to terminate someone if they keep using more time than they have accrued? Well, that's going to depend on sort of making sure you're treating everybody consistently. Hopefully you have a policy that makes clear that attendance issues that are not protected, and those would not be, will be dealt with, and typically that's going to result in some sort of warning about using more time off than you've accrued, and eventually you could terminate somebody so long as they don't have sick leave that they could have used, which brings me to a point. I see a lot of employers sort of allowing employees to be absent and not paying out accrued sick leave. So they've got this accrued sick leave in a bank somewhere. They're calling in sick, but they're not requesting to use it. And so the employer is not paying it out. And so they're essentially letting folks have these unpaid absences sort of throughout the year. The problem with that is at some point they may have so many absences that you want to start the disciplinary process. But if they've got a bunch of sick leave sitting in a bank somewhere that you didn't pay out, that's going to be very difficult to discipline them when they're sick for a sick leave purpose. If they've got that time sitting there in a bank, you have to allow them to use it, and you can't retaliate against them. So my recommendation is, you know, pay this time out. Burn through this time as fast as you can so that when attendance continues to be an issue, you'll have a much stronger position in terms of disciplining. So don't wait for them to request the time. If they are absent for a sick leave purpose, pay it out. So a couple questions, and I think some of these folks may have had or been our folks who had audio issues early on, and we apologize for that. But in terms of just some basics, you know, 1 hour for every 40 hours worked, this is based on actually worked, not necessarily hours that may be paid. So if you're on some sort of paid leave or you're having a paid holiday, sick leave does not have to accrue based on those hours because you didn't actually work them. It's really just hours worked. Yeah, and same question here. If somebody's got sick leave in a bank somewhere, can you force them to use it, or can they essentially hoard it to be used later? Well, you know, the way I look at it is if you don't have leave available, then you can't be absent. But I think there's a lot of employers who allow people to take unpaid leave sort of kind of willy-nilly. So my view is if they don't have time to use, then they can't be absent. So if they are absent, make them use their time so that you can sort of avoid this hoarding issue. Any other questions that would make sense to address? Let's see.
So is sick leave paid out when someone is laid off? You certainly could have a policy of paying out sick leave. It is not required under the law. That would be just based on your policy.
Here's a question about a bullet point under the Tacoma's paid sick leave. What does the payout of accrued leave over 40 hours per year mean? So this is a quirky function of the new law where under the new Washington law, right, you can't cash out. So some people have cash out policies for existing employees. So a lot of them cash out upon termination. But for existing employees, you can only cash out paid leave that's beyond 40 hours. So if somebody at the end of the calendar year has 30 hours of accrued but unused leave, you can't cash that out according to the law. You have to, it would only be if someone has 50 hours, you have to allow them to carry over the 40, and then you could cash them out those 10 hours. Now, frankly, you know, I think employees who are eligible for these policies like to be cashed out, and if it's a voluntary, you know, if they are asking to be cashed out and you cash them out, you know, is a charge probably going to result from that practice? Probably not, but according to the law, you're not supposed to allow folks to cash out anything under that 40-hour carryover cap. Anything else out there? Let's see. If you do front load, how often do you need to review the accrual for any overtime worked? You know, there's no rule on that, but and I think the first year you're probably going to want to review it pretty frequently just to make sure if you're front loading for someone who ends up working a lot more hours than you anticipate. At least on a quarterly basis, maybe 6 months you can get away with down the road, but I think you're going to have to play that sort of by ear and see who's accruing more and then adjust at that time. But adjusting it, is the sooner the better if you're noticing that folks should have been accruing more than you front-loaded them.
Question about reinstatement says, reinstatement within 12 months, so with seasonal employees, this would then apply, correct? Yes, that's correct. If you have seasonal employees that are coming back within 12 months, you would reinstate their sick leave balance at the time of termination, and you would also count their prior service toward their 90-day waiting period.
So you don't have to cash out sick leave over under 40 hours? I guess the question is, so we have to cash out sick leave under 40 hours. No. So there's no requirement to cash out sick leave, period, whether it's for existing employees or when employees separate from employment. When employees separate from employment, you are free to cash them out any amount that is remaining. For existing employees, you're only allowed to cash out any balance above 40 hours. So if they've accrued 50 hours, you have to force them to carry over 40 to the following year, and then you can, at your option, cash out 10, or you can just that can just go away and be forfeited. So there's no requirement to cash out, but if it's for existing employees, there's some rules around how much you can cash out. Will we be doing a sample notice to employees? We've got a variety of notices. You know, we've been revising a lot of policies, and it really depends on the language of your policy that you're already working with, but we'd be happy to talk to you about that if you want to contact us afterward.
Somebody's asking, if somebody works a lot of OT, and can you figure that out at the end of the year and add that additional time then? Is there a rule on that? And what the rules say is that if you have fallen behind in what you've given them and on maybe under a front-loading system, you're supposed to supplement their bank within 30 days of those accruals that exceeded what you've already given to them. So because of that 30-day requirement, you might, you know, especially as you're getting toward the end of a year on a front-loading system, try to check in and just make sure that people aren't getting close to that mark and exceeding the front-loading that you already gave them earlier.
Question about if you provide more sick leave hours than required by the new state law. For example, if someone uses over 72 hours per year, the Seattle PSST maximum, we could discipline for that right now as of today. Can we still use that threshold when determining excessive usage? The answer is no, because the state law does not allow for a use cap or an accrual cap. You can't have any bright line number. That is one of the amendments to the Seattle ordinance as well. Seattle is taking out their use cap to be more consistent with the state law. So if it is anything within their protected leave accrual, you cannot discipline for it. There is no number that's a bright line.
So for all you out there who, it sounds like we've got a lot of people on the line who offer generous PTO, either generous sick leave or generous PTO. And so there's a real concern that now those entire banks are going to be subject to all these rules. So really, again, the only way you can avoid that, because it's right, if you have a PTO bucket of 100 hours a year and you don't designate some of that separately to comply with this new law, if anybody has a sick leave purpose absent and they have any of those 100 hours, they can use, and you can't require extra notice, you can't sort of deny these leaves, you can't retaliate, those sorts of things. So the only way to fix that is to either have, is it either be okay with that, and maybe you are, you know, because if someone can use it to go to Hawaii, maybe it's fine if they can use it for sick leave too. The other way to deal with it is to designate a portion of the PTO, track it separately, and say this smaller bucket, this subset of PTO, is what we use to comply with the Washington law, and it's only that bucket that's going to have all those bells and whistles apply. Now you got to make sure that when people use their PTO, you got to know, is it for a sick leave purpose or not? You're going to have to get some information to see which bucket to take it away from. But a lot of our clients are really starting to move away from PTO, or at least having a separate sick leave bucket that is perfectly compliant, minimally compliant, 1 hour for 40 hours worked, just kind of functions exactly how the law intends. And then having a separate bucket that you can have sort of be your more generous, either it's PTO or it's vacation or it's something else, you can do whatever you want with, but making sure you've got a perfectly compliant sick leave bucket is probably the easiest way logistically to sort of deal with this, particularly if you offer quite a lot more leave. All right. Well, I think we're getting close to out of time here, or actually we're out of time. So what we'll do is, you know, you've got all of our email addresses there. Please feel free to reach out to one of us if you've got a question that we didn't get to. We'll see what we can do in terms of answering them. We're always happy to look at policies and give you sort of more pointed advice there. But we hope you've got at least some things to start thinking about. We don't have a whole lot of time because it goes into effect in January, but we're happy to help you in any way we can. So we appreciate it. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.
A link to the online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. We thank you for attending.